From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the pages of a novel called A Replacement Life. The book opens with a kind of question. What would you do if someone you love, someone who is family, comes to you to ask you to do something that is illegal? But it's not quite as simple as that. What if this illegal act could be seen as a kind of long-awaited justice for past wrongs, but the kind that won't really hurt anyone today? What if delivering justice is within your grasp, but could put you in trouble with the law? At the center of Boris Fishman's novel is Holocaust reparations. A young writer, 25-year-old Slava Gelman, has just lost his beloved grandmother. In Slava's mind, she was the one who suffered most in the Holocaust. His grandfather, Yevgeny, well, suffered, sure, as a Jew during the war, but not like Slava's grandmother. So Slava finds himself in a dilemma when Yevgeny comes with a request. "You're a writer," he tells his grandson. "Write my story of suffering in order to secure a reparations payment." Who would know if it wasn't Yevgeny who suffered the way the story describes, but his late wife? Someone should pay. Slava eventually takes the job, which quickly grows to include similar forgeries and fabrications. And soon he has to wrestle with whether he wants to continue and what he thinks is right. And soon he has to contend with the authorities, who appear to be on to the ruse. A remarkable book, and Rochester's Writers and Books has chosen A Replacement Life for their debut novel series. Boris Fishman will be in Rochester for a series of events starting 10 days from now, talking about his book, talking about the publishing process, talking about, well, what aspiring authors should know. But first, Boris Fishman is my guest on Connections. Boris, congratulations and thanks for taking the time.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much. I'm happy to talk to you.
And Joe Flaherty is with us in studio. He's the executive director of Writers and Books. Joe, always nice to see you. Always something going on at Writers and Books.
Good to see you, Evan. Yeah, we have a great lineup of things going all the time.
And now Boris is going to be here starting in 10 days, but kind of lay out the schedule coming up, because there's a lot coming up here related to the debut novel series.
Well, this Thursday we're going to have a book discussion about the book. It's going to take place at Writers and Books, and that's going to be at 7 o'clock. And people have a chance to kind of talk about it. You know, what are the issues raised in it? What background do they relate to, this background of an immigrant coming in? It's an immigrant story in a very real way. And then the next Thursday, Boris will be here. And then on Thursday evening at 7:30, he's going to be at the School of the Arts Auditorium for a reading and talk about his book, discussion afterwards. And then the following day, Friday, he will be doing a talk about his process. How did he get to be a writer? How did he get published? How did this novel happen to come out? So it's a kind of a interesting way for people who could be writers or readers to find out how do you get to that point where your book comes out and gets these terrific reviews. And then on Saturday morning, on April 11th at 10, which we do all the time, is a chance for people who are really serious writers in the community to take part in a masterclass in which he'll talk about the craft of writing. So there's a lot of opportunities for people to see and hear him.
Well, and to Joe's point about the great reviews, nothing short of the New York Times had a review that said, quote, "Is there room in American fiction for another brilliant young emigre writer? There had better be, because here he is. Boris Fishman's first novel, A Replacement Life, is bold, ambitious, and wickedly smart." And Boris, I know by the time you put this novel out, you'd written in many highly regarded publications, and maybe you had a feeling that this could work. But when you see that kind of a review, it has to be remarkably rewarding.
Well, if I had an idea that this would work, I was progressively disabused of it by the in the years of rejection, through the years of rejection.
Is that right?
Oh, yes, as I worked on this novel. I mean, yes, I started out in journalism after college, and I got to publish in some nice places at a fairly young age. But an 800-word article in the New York Times is nothing like a 100,000-word novel. Also, journalism and publishing are two very different beasts. Journalism and fiction are as well. It took some time to learn that. But basically, I did 12 drafts over 3.5 years, and sort of each one found a way to be punctuated by some kind of discouragement from someone, but also some encouragement from some corner as well, which is what kept me going. But suffice it to say that while my skin was a lot thicker by the time the novel was published, at the same time, I was so grateful to see it out in the world. I I mean, make no mistake, writers have serious egos, but at that point, I wasn't even thinking about the reception. It's hard to believe in retrospect, but I really wasn't. I just hoped that the Times would review it. Honestly, that was my great aspiration. And then so when this happened, it was, surreal is the only word for it.
Well, and, you know, Boris, I think, you are disabusing our own audience from assuming that anyone with a byline in The New Yorker has every door opened, even though, there you go, on page 12, Slava writes for Century, but there, you know, he wants to be a successful writer, and it says there were no guarantees, but a byline in Century, only a byline in The New Yorker meant as much. Entire book contracts were given out on the basis of a byline in Century. And so the irony is that you had a byline in The New Yorker, but you didn't just snap your fingers and get the contract you wanted.
No, I think you have to be older than 24 for that to happen. and that was a short piece. I think you need a real record of publication before that happens. The important thing is those things do open doors, but they don't walk you through them. And this is both this is actually a nice thing. Like, connections will only get you so far. Just because you happen to know someone, it's a huge thing. They might take a second longer to look at your manuscript as a result. But the connection alone will not get you the contract, or certainly it didn't in my case. And this is part of the reason that when I talk to young writers, a lot of them are either really shy about approaching people with more knowledge than they have about the business, and others really look down on it because they think of it as networking. I think both of those viewpoints are really, really wrong. If you're ever next to someone who happens to know a lot more than you do or has a lot more power than you do in the business that you care about, your job is to go and talk to them and ask them to educate you about this thing that you want to be good at, because fiction today, publishing today, it's 50% creative, 50% business. There's just no way around that. I'm sort of drifting off topic, but it's important for me to point that out because there's some thought. Publishing is a kind of dark art. You know, a lot of the machinery is concealed. So there's a lot of guessing going on about how it works and what gets a book published. And it seems like it's this in one case, but this in another. And what nobody realizes is that the emperor really has no clothes. There's no system to the madness whatsoever. But when I can shed a little bit of light, I try to do that.
We're talking to Boris Fishman, the author of A Replacement Life, a novel that has been reviewed remarkably favorably, and he's going to be in Rochester starting next Thursday as part of the debut novel series, the 9th through the 11th, with a series of events, not only talking about the book, but also, as we've been talking about, the process. We're going to get to more of the process in our second half hour, but if you don't mind indulging, Boris, I'd love to talk a bit about the book itself. And I told Joe Flaherty before the hour started, some of our listeners are going to start to think that I'm a Writers and Books sycophant because they have these events, and Karen Thompson Walker was in recently for her book. I really enjoyed her book, and I'm certainly not afraid to say it, but I
serendipitously met her this weekend.
I know, I heard that. Of all the people for you to bump into and spend time with, Boris and Karen Thompson Walker.
She was raving about Rochester.
Joe, that's a nice endorsement.
Very nice, yes. I mean you talk about small towns. I mean, in Rochester, you know, people could bump into each other that way, but in Brooklyn or Manhattan or wherever it was, that's really pretty incredible.
Yeah, and so Karen, just the author of The Age of Miracles, if all of Rochester read the same book for 2015, she just departed after a series of events here. Boris coming in for the debut novel series, and I loved it. I loved A Replacement Life. Boris, there are some authors who I think struggle to create textured characters, and it seemed like every one of the characters in this book had natural, interesting layers to them, starting with Slava and some of his struggle with his own family, etc. But why don't we just kind of back up, and if you could set the stage for our listeners, because a lot of people have not picked up a novel about Holocaust reparations and you know, at the core of it. So kind of set the stage, if you could, for the characters and where A Replacement Life begins.
Right. Well, the Holocaust stuff is really the departure point for what I hoped would be a larger conversation about, are the law and justice always the same thing? And if not, how much space has to exist between them before it becomes okay to take the law into your own hands? The other big question for me was, how do you honor elders whose definition of honor is different from yours, which is a really pressing question for immigrant families, because your elders have committed this great sacrifice for you, taken you out of that place, brought you to this one. But there's a very bittersweet price tag attached, because with each day, you become more and more foreign to each other, because they probably came at a fairly advanced age, and so they remain, in my case, in my family's case, Soviet in their thinking and psychology, whereas I become more of an American every day. And so the bridge between us gets more and more stretched. And so the question becomes, you want to honor these people for what they did for you. How do you do it if you define honor differently? And so this is what Slava faces in the novel. Slava, like me, is settled in South Brooklyn by his family, which were a lot of, I mean, in those neighborhoods, you're likelier to hear Russian than you are English. But what does a kid want most of all after coming to America from a different country? It's to fit in. He's desperate to get out. He runs off to Manhattan, forbids everyone to call and write. And of course, there's no greater sin for a Russian Jewish child to commit than to cut off his family. And then this beloved grandmother of his dies, and he knows that she was a Holocaust survivor, but like survivors of any great trauma, she was never eager to talk about it and managed to elude him every time that he pressed her for those stories. And now the opportunity to learn what she went through has been sacrificed forever by this identity project of his, where he just doesn't want to be around people like him. So when he comes back to Brooklyn for the first time in a year, he's very susceptible to this unsavory scheme that his grandfather has cooked up, which, as you mentioned, is write the claim about grandmother instead. Just put my name on it. And the argument that grandfather makes is that, okay, I didn't suffer in the exact way I need to have suffered. But you know what? They made sure to kill all the people who did. And as much as Slava wants to equate true American living with a certain kind of moral high-mindedness and getting away from all that hustling and scraping that goes on in South Brooklyn, that immigrant way of living that he wants to get away from, he can't help being influenced by grandfather's argument. And over the course of the novel, part of the reason he starts forging these letters is because, A, grandfather begins to make a kind of sense to him, but B, Slava wants to become a writer, but it's not as simple as taking a pad and pencil in your hands. Slava encounters here an opportunity. This woman has died. He never got to know her in real life. And so here is an opportunity to invent on the page a woman that he never got to know in life. And what I'm trying to propose through the novel is that our ability to know things and to imagine things doesn't end sort of with this world. One of the most gratifying things to have happened to me is someone came up to me after a reading and said, you know what, I did what Slava did. My grandparents passed. I had bits of family lore like we all do. I read some history books, and I put all that together to create some plausible narratives of what they might have gone through. And in my head, I know it's false, and yet I feel so much closer to these people who left this world before I got a chance to know them. And I thought that was so affecting.
Yeah, and Slava is shocked by his grandmother's death because he kind of admits that she's a Holocaust survivor. She's been through so much. Every time she seemed to have an ailment in the past, she comes out of it. And he's gripped by the fact that she is... there's a permanence, that she's gone, that he's lost that chance. Just for me, Boris, I don't know if I feel compelled to fill in gaps of a loved one's story, but I am, after reading this, instantly compelled to just grab a recorder and sit down with family members and not wait, if that makes sense.
I say that at every reading. You know, depending on what the audience is. If the audience is young, I say go home and grab your elders. If the audience is older, I say go home and force your kids to sit down, even if ostensibly nothing dramatic has happened in your family's life and you've been blessed to live a fairly quiet life on safe shores. All the same, there are stories, and they have a tremendous amount of import for family bonds and connections. I mean, it's especially, that's amplified for an immigrant family because, you know, you leave your soil behind. Your stories are kind of your portable home. But even in a native family, I think that has the power to bond the generations in a way few other things can. Because even in a non-immigrant family, generations just see the world so differently. But stories, they sort of run vertically and connect them.
You have mentioned in some interviews, and I want to look up the phrase that you've used, the Soviet Union of the Soul, you've used that phrase. You know, that phrase for, as you were just describing it, this notion of, if you think you're coming to the United States, for example, and starting anew, still being surrounded by people from a same homeland, a same dialect, a same language, a same custom. Whereas someone like Slava, you almost want to shake him and say, I know you want to start fresh, but you should show some appreciation for sacrifice. It's interesting. It's an interesting dichotomy.
Well, I mean, Slava begins the novel as a kind of emotional fundamentalist, I call him. You know, but we shouldn't judge him too harshly, because this is what it means to be 20-something. You don't know yet that there are no clear answers to anything that matters. You don't know yet that nothing is ever black and white. You know, we all remember ourselves when we were 19 and we thought that we had discovered the ultimate truth about the world. And that's what Slava is like. And it's sort of, so he runs off to America, and it's only when he, against his wishes, so to speak, returns. It's only when he returns to his home neighborhood and its predicaments that he becomes an American, ironically, for a variety of reasons. But that's the journey that he has to go through in the course of the novel. Growing up for him means realizing that the truth about things is more complex and never as clear as, what, am I 100% American, 100% Russian? Well, neither. For an immigrant, that's not a possibility.
I also, as a reader, you know eventually that a certain ruse has to, something has to come back to him. And I was wondering, you know, how is he going to choose to answer certain questions about why he made certain choices and what justice is to him and what should come out of it? And I don't want to give away where we end up, but I thought it was beautifully done without being too pat. But why don't you talk a little bit about that question? When you say a lie is not always a falsehood is not only a lie. Why did that intrigue you so much, Boris?
Well, just because, you know, I spent 3 years as a fact checker at The New Yorker, which is very rigorous about its facts. It, you know, sort of famously has a department of 16 people devoted to doing nothing but that. But ironically, it is that, and seeing just how much can be verified, that also teaches you how much can't, you know? And there simply are certain things. Like, let's just talk about fiction in general. Fiction is a lie. Fiction is a falsehood. Except I think all of us, at the very least elementally, can agree that sometimes fiction can find its way to a deeper truth than any work of nonfiction. In the same way, I often find that things are true in spirit, but not in fact. And, like, for example, let's talk about the young woman who came up to me after the reading. We know that she has invented this history for her family, but can't we imagine, over the generations, little by little, these stories sort of becoming fact, quote unquote, inside her family, and there's a game of telephone through the generations where her grandkids no longer know or remember, or whatever the right verb is, that this was invented. Now we know that right now at this point in time that stuff was is not true, and yet let's put that on the scale against the import of having those stories in her family and what they give to their connections and family life together. I'm not sure that the import of fact wins out. You see what I'm saying? And so I just want to, in the same way that Slava desperately wants to live in a black and white world, because you're so mixed up as a fresh immigrant, you want that clarity, but he painfully learns through in the course of the novel that just isn't an option if you intend to be an adult. In the same way, I wanted to sort of exhort my readers to remember how much of fiction actually comes from fact, how any kind of nonfiction, no matter how rigorous, even a biography, even an academic biography, is invariably a reconstruction, and a selective one at that, of what really happened. So I just wanted to gray things up, that's all.
Talking to Boris Fishman, the author of A Replacement Life, his book chosen as part of the debut novel series at Writers and Books, and Boris will be here 10 days from now, next Thursday, April 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the School of the Arts Auditorium for a public reading and book signing. And then he's going to talk about the publishing process, I should say, next Friday, the 10th, at Writers and Books, and then Saturday, the 11th, at 10 in the morning at Writers and Books, a writer's masterclass with Boris Fishman. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves too much, Boris, but there's a lot I want to get to, so I will just say, as we talk about a writer's masterclass, as someone who reads for this program a lot, mm-hmm. your prose is among the most Wow. Look at the irony. I can't say the word effortless. Effortlessly effective and descriptive without crossing over into purple prose. Sometimes you find someone who is so good with language, but they don't know how to turn it off at times. You sort of vary between these beautiful, vivid descriptors, often of a physical setting or a moment or a scene, and then you can shift to pages upon pages of effective dialogue without clouding it with those kind of descriptors, or just sort of an austerity of a moment that lets the emotion of a moment speak for itself. And I guess where I'm going with this is, how cognizant are you of a writer of wanting to write that descriptively, but also wanting not to create purple prose?
Oh, painfully, painfully cognizant. I mean, the reason it took 12 drafts was partly because of that. I mean, as a beginning writer, I was so anxious to show my readers, like, look how impressive I can be. Look how much I've learned. And so it was just so horribly overwritten, a draft after draft after draft. But I also didn't like the typical solution to that, which is just to pare down your prose to a kind of emotionless flatness, you know, where it can never be accused of sentimentality, but it kind of can't be accused of sentiment either. There's just nothing in it. You know, there's no feeling in it. I didn't want to do that. So here's another great example of what I've taken to calling the grayness of experience. I had to learn how to press forward and restrain myself at the same time. Fill a sentence with as much personality, flourish, flair, and color as it could hold, but never so much that sort of the water runs over the edge of the cup, you know? And it's a balancing act every time. And there are a couple of spots, I think, where I went overboard. But it was one of them. One of them, you know, you learn so much in the course of writing a novel. It's like you put yourself through a second graduate school in writing. And this was one of the most, this and how to write dialogue are two of the most exciting things I learned how to do in the course of writing the novel. And also, the other thing that helped me a lot was, of course, I'm drawn to writers who write big. I'm thinking of William Styron. You know, I mean, that man's sentences are just, they're just glorious sentences. They're so plush. But I learned an equal amount from someone like Graham Greene, who is actually quite concise, but there's so much personality and even humor in these fairly short sentences. I mean, he says, he could have been a poet if he wanted. I mean, he says with one word what it takes mortals 10 to say. And then you have someone like J.M. Coetzee, if you know him, the South African writer. He wrote that incredible novel, Disgrace. And he is just so austere, not only in his feeling, but in his prose. And you would think it would be a novel that I would struggle to get through. But when he finally breaks into emotion at the end of these 220 pages, I mean, it's worth so much more because it's been so austere leading up to that. And that taught me a great lesson in terms of balance and things like that. So it was on my mind, as you can tell, every step of the way. I mean, I wrote and rewrote the same sentences a dozen times in order to achieve that balance.
Well, it's very effectively done, and I'm curious to know. Then you thank a lot of people in your acknowledgments, and every author does. But given your description of what you just gave us about your approach there, what do you tell aspiring authors about the willingness to be edited, especially when they think they've created a sentence or a paragraph that is the most beautifully constructed thing ever, and someone comes in there and takes a hatchet to it?
Well, I would hope that no one... One of the best pieces of advice that I got when I was working on the novel was from a novelist named Salvatore Sabona, who wrote a novel called The End that came out back in 2009. He was the administrator at a writing residency that I attended, and he said, hold on to it for as long as you can, and which is hard to do because you're just raring to get out of the gate. You're doing this bizarre thing with your life that no one understands. You know, still working on that novel, Boris, you know? And and you're desperate for a referendum on your skills. But what Salvatore was saying is, polish till you can't polish anymore, then put it aside for 3 months and start polishing again. And so it is my great hope that no one turns anything in before they've taken a very long time and exhausted their own ideas about what can be improved. I distinctly remember I did 150 pages of the first draft, sent it off to an agent who had said she would be willing to look at what I'd written. And she wrote back and said, Boris, you yourself don't know yet what this novel is about. You'll find out only when you get to the last page. And when you do, you will want to go back to page one and rewrite the whole thing, because now you know what it's about. So don't get back to me until you're done with draft two. And that was such a great, great piece of advice. And so I know some writers say, oh, it's the muse, you know, I'm visited by the muse, and it's so organic, it comes out, it just, you know, can't be touched. I mean, this is silly talk. I don't even know how to address it. There's no room. I mean, if Hemingway had to revise, you have to revise. I mean, I don't know what else to say but that.
Boris Fishman, the author of A Replacement Life. The second I mentioned the prose, Joe was scrambling for the novel. I suspect that was just a sign that you're looking at me, Joe, saying, yes, if you give me 5 minutes, I'll find 10 examples.
Well, no, I mean, one of the things I loved about it, Boris, is that the voice of the narrator it's an American, but it also is a Russian Jewish voice. I mean, there's idioms that are in there that you know allow you to live in those both worlds. And there are times that you even say, you know, there's really no English word for this,
right?
Or there's no Russian word for this. You know, that kind of moving back between the two languages and doing it in such a wonderful way that the reader can sense. And then there's times that you're talking and then you don't quite realize till later when that entire conversation took place in Russian. But you do let us know. So for us reading it, we move in this in these two worlds in the very same way that Slava does. And we can move as a result of your writing easily back and forth, and it's just one of the real triumphs of the book, I think.
I'm so gratified to hear that, because I wanted to create for the reader. I wanted to, and for the reader to feel a slight sense of dislocation and estrangement of the kind that Slava feels all the time. That sense of sort of being a real visitor. Like, you're a visitor in this novel. You're not a native. And one of the ways that I did that is by making the dialogue and the prose non-standard. It has all these inflections and strange punctuation and odd syntax where subjects and verbs are reversed. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to create a slight sense of a novel in translation, essentially.
Yes.
Which
yes.
It isn't, but I wanted it to feel like one. Why? Because, I mean, for the same reason that in the movies, every Nazi officer speaks with a British accent, right? That's how you know you're dealing with a foreigner. Well, here, Joe, as you very astutely said, they're all speaking Russian to each other, but they're speaking Russian fluently. So there's no reason to misspell English words, which is so often what some writers resort to in order to indicate that these are foreigners. No, it should be fluent, but let me mess around with the inflection so that you get the sense that, I mean, what they're actually doing is speaking Russian, but with Yiddish inflection.
Mm-hmm.
Because their parents and grandparents spoke only Yiddish. They've lived too long in the Soviet Union to speak a Jewish language because it's been suppressed in an atheist country, so they're speaking Russian, but between the lines, it still sounds like Yiddish. So there's this crazy triangle going on, and I'm trying to fire on all these cylinders at the same time. I'm really grateful it came through.
Yeah,
it did. And before I turn over the second half of this conversation into more about the process, just real briefly, taking back our readers to A Replacement Life starts in 2006, and you were writing it. You actually began the physical process of writing this when, Boris?
In 2009, the reason the novel takes place in 2006 is entirely arbitrary. There's a good story attached, but that actually has to do with the process, so we can save it till the second half of the hour, if you wish.
Okay, but for you, it's interesting that there were some news headlines about the very subject that was fictionally covered in your book, but that was something that happened afterwards, right? When it came to some,
yeah.
Can you speak to that? Because I know people have said, "Wow, that must have dovetailed right around that time." But more coincidence
exactly
than anything.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but a really odd one, because I started writing in the fall of 2009, and I had finished a draft by September 2010. And then in November 2010, there was this article in the New York Times saying that a whole bunch of people were arrested in South Brooklyn for doing exactly what I had described in the novel. And they had been caught for more or less the same reasons that my people get caught in the novel. And, I mean, my characters. And, I mean, they had been doing it since the early 90s. They just hadn't been caught till 2010 and had been made public till then. But, yeah, I mean, I tried actually not to read too much about the real-life version of what had happened, because by then I had my own ideas, and sometimes research can be intrusive in that way. Mm-hmm. And trying to, you know, you start feeling like you're constantly measuring the distance between what you're creating and what really happened, and it's not always necessary in fiction. Sometimes it is, but not always. So, but one bit of insulation that provided is, you know, I come from a culture where I mean, it's an Eastern culture, essentially. You don't air dirty laundry. It's not this culture of disclosure and confession that we have in America, not at all. And so I think I would have faced a lot more skepticism and dislike for my own community had this not been made public, had this not really happened in real life and been exposed, you know? So anytime someone says, how could you, I have something to point to.
Talking to Boris Fishman, the author of A Replacement Life, a novel. He'll be in Rochester 10 days from now, but the first event is a book discussion on his book, and that is Thursday night at 7 o'clock at Writers and Books, as the opening event in this debut novel series events with Boris. Short break, and we're going to talk about that process, the publication process. So many people have this dream of getting published, and it is tough. And Boris is now, well, I don't know if he feels like he's on the pinnacle of it. He probably wouldn't say the pinnacle. Who knows what that even feels like? But he has found a great amount of success, and we're going to talk about what's next and what that process is like. So short break and much more with Boris when we come back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we've been hearing a lot from Fairport Superintendent Bill Calla and some others when it comes to the schools debate, the teacher evaluations, and the proposed reforms from Governor Cuomo. Tuesday, we hear from Brighton Superintendent, who takes a slightly different tack. We'll hear from him. Then second hour, we're talking colon cancer awareness. Join us Tuesday on Connections.
One eighth grade teacher in Nashville is part of a bold new experiment.
The weight of this 100 students is on my shoulder, but I have a team that is strong enough where I say, hey guys, we gotta get this done. They follow me.
Putting great teachers in charge of other teachers and other classrooms. That's later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. You heard the author, Boris Fishman, mention that it took many drafts and some years before A Replacement Life was published. No guarantee that it would find an audience, let alone the success it has. And so, Boris, sometimes we hear that the publishing industry has become risk-averse, and yet you are putting forward a novel that did have some curveballs, as we've been talking about with just the dialogue and the language. And Joe and I were talking during the break. I went back, I think I was on page 300. I went back and I said, how many times have I been reading conversations that actually were in Russian? I'm trying to remind myself.
Right.
And was there a risk in doing things a different way when you didn't have a publishing track record, when you are trying to break through for the first time in an industry that is gaining a reputation for risk aversion?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this comes down to the kind of person you are. You know, I was having a conversation with a relative who shall remain nameless for his sake, and he said, why make things so hard for yourself? Do you know this thing that James Patterson does? Why don't you just do that? And then, like, when you've made money, then you can settle into that this impossible stuff that you want to do. And I said to him, God, how I wish I could. I would love nothing more. I'm just not capable of writing like James Patterson. It takes certain things to write like James Patterson. It's not effortless. And if you can't help writing stories like this, these are the stories you must write. You are making life for yourself a lot harder. There is a small place for literary novels out there. However, I think some of the doomsaying is a little misguided, because What has always amazed me about publishing, and by always I just mean since I really started learning about it, is it is still full of people who really care about art, who really care about books. You know, the literary fiction department at each of the houses may have shrunk, but it still exists. It still gets a lot of clout. It still has a fair amount of money. And it's full of people who really, really care about books. And when you're writing a novel like this, you are depending on that one person who sees what you're trying to do and becomes so crazy enthusiastic about it that they're willing to go out in the world and maim and kill for you, because that's what you have to do in order to get a novel some notice. And you may not find that person. I was fortunate enough to find her in an editor at HarperCollins who needed to publish this book. And that's the kind of connection you hope to make. It may not happen. I had not made it previously in other experiences. And so it is a very small needle to thread with a very thick cable. But what's the alternative? I mean, I tried so hard to make myself satisfied doing other things. The last job I held before turning to the novel full-time was as I was the editorial director of a tech startup, a hotel review site. They essentially paid me six figures to go around the world and stay in hotel rooms and review them. And I had the audacity to be miserable while doing this. You know? And at a certain point, you just say, okay, I've tried so hard, because I am the kind of person who needs to feel passionate about what he's doing, otherwise I'll just die. And I couldn't find it even in that job. To their great credit, they saw it and fired me. Paving the way.
Thank goodness for you.
Seriously, I knew the relationship was over when my boss walked up to me and gave me a book called Getting Rid of the Words, Writing on the Web. And I knew sort of the relationship was the wrong one. When he gave me the book, and he was like, this is very useful. You should learn from this when you're writing those reviews. Getting Rid of the Words. So they did me a favor, and I started working on the novel. So, but I do have to say that please don't do this professionally, I mean, unless you feel that way about it. Because there's so much humiliation, there's so much privation, there's so much hard times, and there's no guarantee that any of it will come to anything. I'm sure people listening to this think, you know, how great for him that he's managed to get somewhere. But the fact is, there are no guarantees. I've very, very happily sold my second novel to HarperCollins. It's coming out next year. But there are no guarantees about the third. Everything depends on how the second one does. And it's a relationship that gets reevaluated every step of the way. It's so hard to plan for your future when you don't know if you'll have a leg to stand on 2 years from now. So it has incredible rewards, but it's really important to be clear-eyed going into it.
Okay, well, again, you're giving me so many different directions I want to take this. But before I do, because I want to challenge this notion that your third book will depend on the success of your second. I have to think A Replacement Life even gives you a free pass if the second one's a dud, and I'm sure it won't be. Jonathan Franzen's probably got a pass, so, you know, but anyway.
But the important thing about Jonathan Franzen is he was writing 20 years ago. The landscape is already so different from what it was even then.
No, that's fair. No, but what I wanted to also touch on, because your answer you just provided came from the question on whether you're willing to take a risk and do something different in a non-standard way in a risk-averse industry. So there was that. And then there was your author's note. And Joe Flaherty, I've seen a lot of author's notes. Maybe I don't read nearly as broadly as Joe does, but have you seen one quite like this before? That he is referring to the origins either of ideas or phrases that came from other places. And Boris, can I read your author's note and then you can talk a little bit about it? Is that all right?
Yes, please. Yes.
I'm just going to read. This is the author's note. The quote: the line between fact and fiction, invention and theft, is as loose as the line between truth and justice. My adopted culture knows this in practice, but forgets it in theory. We are transgressives in private and Puritans when caught. Itself a savory self-deception. This affects literature as much as politics or mortgage lending. Sometimes we struggle to remember that fiction is often nonfiction warped by artifice, and nonfiction unavoidably a reinvention of what actually happened. I am stealing these words from myself, from a book review I once wrote. There are lines, of course, but they're further out than we think. Life is sin and art is theft. Let mine in this novel register as a reminder of this, as well as a tribute to authors who have said something of meaning to me. End quote. And from there, Boris goes on to mention, looks to me, a couple dozen different references in the book. Different lines. For example, page 297, quote, Slava could have risen and gone four ways at once. That comes from Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment. So, Boris, you didn't have to do that. I mean, that to me was a remarkable addendum. Why did you want to add that?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I mean, I think you do have to do that if you're stealing verbatim.
Okay, well, I do agree with that. That's comforting to know that you have that ethical bar, because I'm sure some have done that and not offered.
Well, I think a lot of people operate in a gray zone where they take not the exact words but the sentiment and put them in their own, and so then it becomes a less clear thing. But I wanted to steal verbatim, partly because it connects to this theme of theft and fraud that is so important to the novel. But more importantly than that, even I wanted to formalize this idea that. There's this, I think, misleading notion in our culture that sometimes that art is born out of nothing. You know, there's a kind of genius auteur sitting with the notebook or in front of an easel and just creating out of nothing as the muse sort of plinks the piano nearby or what have you. That is just not at all what happens. Like, every work of art, consciously or unconsciously, borrows and steals from the things that have come before it. I mean, you could call it influence, you could call it theft, you could call it whatever you want, but the fact is that nothing is ever made out of whole cloth. And I wanted to formalize that. I mean, I read so many people before I wrote my novel, and I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use their language in mine, but then I'm going to acknowledge it, because I think that's the way to do it. You know, we got some serious hang-ups in our culture about plagiarism.
But we should, shouldn't we?
Yes. Absolutely. But this, again, it's a gray area and a matter of degrees. I think we go overboard. Sometimes I think we forget to check the intention as opposed to the execution. And so, you know, like I said before, we treat biographies as fact. Well, it isn't. And we read a kind of a first novel that is quite obviously a transcript of what happened to the person, but we regard it as fiction also fine. But let's just be aware how blurry and porous the lines really are, and let's dispense with this idea that it's possible to create something that isn't, everything is plagiaristic. So once again, I'm not trying to turn the picture upside down, just complicate and add nuance to some of these notions that I think obtain unhelpfully in the culture.
Yeah, I've never seen it worded or phrased quite like that, and that was very interesting to me. But building on that question then, because you mentioned artistic creation is either borrowing consciously or unconsciously, how much do you think we should try to peer into our own creation and figure out in a more conscious way where it is coming from? In other words, do we risk, I don't know if plagiarism is a word, I know you say we are hung up on it, but do we risk allowing ourselves to borrow too heavily if we're not more cognizant of our own influences?
Well, you know, there's also this popular idea that that artists should not be analyzed because it risks messing with the gift. Well, I couldn't disagree more. I believe those are very different parts of the brain. My writing has only gotten better and more venturesome the more time I have spent analyzing myself, both informally and formally. And you know what? I know exactly how it works. You're sitting in front of a blank page. You're desperate to fill it. You know, you're in the middle of a sentence where you've been for the past 25 minutes. You're desperate to finish the damn sentence. And you remember that William Styron in Sophie's Choice wrote it this way. And you put it in, because you were just reading it. I'm citing, obviously, from something that really happened. And because you're sort of in that writing trance, you don't set a moment aside to write down in your notebook, like page 67, stole from Styron, acknowledge it later, or change it, you know?
Right.
And then it just sort of fritters away. And then you have to reread your manuscript so many times just during revision, you forget that that's Styron's language instead of your own. Now, that novel comes out, and some person who just, you know, we live in a real gotcha culture, and some snoop goes, aha, he stole from Styron. Now, two things. One, you should make an effort right in that moment to write it down. There's no reason you can't. Like the great momentum will not abandon you. At the same time, we can agree it's an innocent action. No, I think plagiarism should be exposed and sort of harshly prosecuted if it was intentional. And it's so often hard to establish what was intentional and what wasn't, but I think you can deduce a general picture from how often it happens, how brazen it is. Mm-hmm. If it's clearly unconscious. And by the way, there are also people in the culture whom we simply allow to lie and to steal, such as Bob Dylan. From what I understand in his memoiristic writing, he just invents stuff all the time. And we just know that, and he's allowed. Why is he allowed but not somebody else, you know? So that's what I was getting at.
Well, what an interesting, it's kind of a meta addition to the subject of the book itself. And so it'll add even more to talk about when Boris is here. Briefly, you received your MFA in fiction from New York University, right, Boris?
That is correct.
I'm sure you have aspiring writers who ask whether they should get an MFA. And again, let me just read a couple. There are myriad articles out there on should you get one, should you not, debates among writers. I am not worshiping at the altar of Franzen, even though I've mentioned him twice now. But Jonathan Franzen says he does not have an MFA. He said, quote, I got married instead to a tough reader with great taste. We had our own little round-the-clock MFA program. This phase of our marriage went on for about 6 years, which is three times longer than the usual program. And Eden Lepucky, author of California, was asked, should you get an MFA? She says, if it's free. She says, quote, I also didn't pay to go, and that's important. My main advice is to you, should you decide to get an MFA, don't spend money or not a lot to get it. Get funded. Anyone who makes the argument that MFA students are rich or going deeply into debt to talk about short stories don't know anything about how these programs work, end quote. Well, you've got an MFA, Boris. Vital to you, and should people get it?
Well, as long as Jonathan Franzen can set up a matchmaking service where we all get connected to such helpful readers, sure, then I'll agree and you don't need an MFA. But I agree completely with with Eden because, first of all, let me say, some people, regardless of what it costs or doesn't, just knock it because they say it turns out kind of predictable robotic prose that's technically proficient but has no soul, you know? Well, have you ever read something that has a ton of soul but no technical proficiency? I mean, it's ugly. It's really, really ugly. There's a great line from Benjamin Franklin, genius without education is like silver left in the mine. And I think that's really true. Like, you need technical proficiency. And you know what? Why should a program be responsible for teaching soul? Who can teach soul? I mean, that is always up to the individual. Also, I found in my program a tremendous community of people in the same terrible leaky boat that I was in, so you feel less alone. I learned so, so much about craft and writing when I was there. But I have to agree with Eden because the bar for what it has to achieve for you just moves so much higher if you have to pay for it. The good news, however, is compared to when I was applying, which was 8 years ago by this point, I feel like so many more programs provide so much more money than they used to. It's possible, especially if you're willing to teach, which you should be, because you'll need that if you ever want to teach professionally down the line. Teaching experience is huge. And so graduate students are allowed to teach in exchange for some tuition remission or whatever. Almost anyone should be able to cobble it together if they're serious enough. And so my unqualified advice is go, yes.
Talking to Boris Fishman for a couple more minutes, the author of A Replacement Life, a novel. Boris, even for those who would love to be published, and even those who are published, not too many will end up in your position. Acclaimed in the New York Times, coming to, coming to Writers and Books in Rochester as part of the debut novel series. It is great success for you. I know your next novel comes out next year, if I'm reading that correctly.
Yes.
But now that you've had this success, I'm curious to know, you know, I mean, I always heard that John Grisham after The Firm had to do 5 books in 3 years, and I don't know. Every contract is different, but do you still feel in control of the process? Are you feeling more pressure to produce? How have things changed for you?
No, I think my editor was startled that I had a second one so quickly. I mean, I think some of this is due to her and the kind of operation she runs. Like, she wants me to create the best work that I can, and whatever needs to happen in order for that to happen, that's what should happen. And even though I've never worked with anyone else, I know enough about the business to know how rare that is. So I love it. Partly because of that, I have managed to retain a sense of great control and independence while working. I did write my second novel before the first one came out. I had a kind of 18-month window after the first one was purchased when I was able to just focus on the second. So who knows, as I start working on my third in a couple of weeks here, actually. But to the extent that I can tell, in my heart, I feel licensed for even more adventure than I've ever felt before in terms of my work. So something must be working.
Joe Flaherty, for our listeners who don't know about the debut novel series, real quick again, run down the events and tell us what the purpose and the goal of the series is.
Well, this was our 15th year of Rochester Reads, and we, thinking of it last year, we said, you know, we'd like to expand it, but do something a little bit different. Keep the annual Rochester Reads, but we wanted to add something else. And we said, well, you know what would be great is there's so many good debut novelists. And, you know, they don't get the same sort of, publicity for their work as people who have been publishing second, third, et cetera. So what we wanted to do was to say, okay, let's bring some of those people here. These are going to be the great writers of tomorrow, and let's introduce them to audiences today. So it was kind of two ways. You know, we have two masters that we serve. It's both the audience and the writers and the writing community, and we thought this was a terrific way of doing both.
Okay. Well, there you go. Thursday night at Writers and Books. What time?
7:00.
All right. That's a discussion of the book. And then 10 days from now, Boris First arrives. That event is where?
That's going to be at School of the Arts. And that's going to be on Thursday at 7:30.
All right. Friday and Saturday as well?
Friday and Saturday. Friday is going to be a talk about his path getting to publishing and writing. And then on Saturday morning at 10, there's going to be a master class talking about the craft of writing.
Boris, I actually love reading really bad writing and really good writing. I don't like reading mediocre writing because bad and good make me a better writer. Your work is phenomenal. I feel like a better writer having read it. Congratulations on all your success. It'll be fun to have you in Rochester.
It'll be great to be there. Thank you so much, Evan. I appreciate it.
Boris Fishman, A Replacement Life, a novel. Absolutely worth your time, even if you feel like you don't have it. Thank you, Joe. Have
Thank
fun
you,
with it.
Evan.
Thanks for coming in. We'll talk to you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.